rise. The Court of Appeals, Division 1, is now in session.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning. We are here for oral argument in our case number 1, CACV 25-0483, Paragon Skydive LLC versus State of Arizona. As a reminder, the proceedings are being video recorded and live streamed. The recording will be uploaded to the court's YouTube channel in the next day or so. Counsel, when you begin, please identify yourself and your client. At the beginning of your argument, each side will have 20 minutes. Appellant may reserve time for rebuttal, but you are responsible for keeping track of your own time. We have read the briefs, and we have conferenced the case. So with that, you may proceed.
May it please the court, Daniel Crane on behalf of the appellant Paragon Skydive LLC. Paragon asks this court to reverse the trial court's two dismissals and the resulting fee award and remand for decision on the merits. Reversal is warranted because the trial court's two rulings dismissing Paragon's claims conflict with each other and result in Paragon being left with no remedy for harm caused by Arizona Department of Transportation as determined by the Federal Aviation Administration. First, the trial court determined that Paragon's notice of claim was defective in that the notices of claim did not detail how Paragon calculated the claimed damages amounts for its lost profits and fees incurred or paid to ADOT. That's not the standard under Arizona law. Arizona law requires that the claimant provide facts it believes supports the settlement amount, not the claimed damages. The second issue that warrants reversal is that the trial court determined it lacked subject matter jurisdiction to enter declaratory relief as to the state law contractual rights held by Paragon because the trial court determined that the FAA had exclusive jurisdiction to determine the FAA's grant assurances, which wasn't the issue. The end result is inequitable. As alleged in the original complaint, Paragon did what ADOT asked. It went to the Federal Aviation Administration when it continued to perceive it was being discriminated against. In front of the Federal Aviation Administration, first in an informal Part 13 complaint, second in a Part 16 formal complaint, Paragon won. So when Paragon won in front of the
Federal... Can you just explain the difference between the informal complaint and the formal complaint?
Certainly, Your Honor. The informal complaint is supposed to be a speedier process. It's under Part 13 of the regulations. The formal complaint is under Part 16 and involves more briefing and results in a decision, director's decision, as was appealed here, with the final agency determination. Ultimately, after the FAA found that ADOT determined that...
Is one required to use the informal process first before submitting a formal complaint, or is that up to the complaining party?
The formal complaint process does require some kind of negotiation between the parties beforehand. So it would be up to the parties as to how they want to do that. But the formal Part 16 complaint does require that there is some negotiations ahead of time. Now, ultimately, Paragon filed this lawsuit because, as has been acknowledged by both parties, the Federal Aviation Administration cannot present a remedy or relief to Paragon. That would be something that was reserved for the state court to do. Ultimately, Paragon was shut out by the trial court through the two decisions that were entered, as well as having a fee award entered for approximately 40% of the amount that ADOT could have settled this entire case before it was even filed. Ultimately, Paragon respectfully requests that this court reverse the trial court's rulings and remand. I'm going to start first with the notice of claim issue. ARS 12-82101A provides, in part, that a notice of claim shall contain facts sufficient to permit the public entity to understand the basis on which liability is claimed. The facts sufficient part is very important. That wasn't challenged by ADOT in the trial court below. What ADOT challenged was that the notice of claim shall also contain a specific amount for which the claim can be settled and facts supporting that amount. The trial court correctly found that the notices of claim, which are Index of Record 20 and 21, did contain specific amounts for which the case could be settled. What the trial court found was that, and this was paragraph 7 of the trial court's ruling index of record 41, was that Paragon did not include facts to explain how it came up with the damages amount that it had, which was the $2 million in lost profit revenue, as well as the $255,000 that Paragon put in its notice of claim for damages it believed it had incurred for fees paid to ADOT, as well as for expenses ADOT caused it to incur. That is not the standard. As discussed in Yollen v. City of Glendale, 219 Arrows 24, this court determined in 2008 that there is that textual difference I mentioned. Sufficient facts for liability, but facts supporting the settlement amount is different, and that's important. The legislature intended it to be. Importantly, this court determined that a claimant doesn't have to provide all facts available to it. It has to provide facts from the claimant's perspective that it thinks supports the damages amount. Certainly, Paragon here in its notice of claim thought that $2 million in lost profits was evidence with $255,000 in what it believed at the time were fees it incurred would support settling the case for $300,000 initially. And then after the final agency decision by the FAA reducing some of the categories of fees, reducing the amount that Paragon would settle the case pre-suit for. Paragon believed that to be the case that's set forth in its notices of claim. Havasupai tribe case is also very relevant and informative to this case. In the Havasupai case, the Havasupai tribe sent a series of notices of claims demanding amounts of $50 million for misuse of blood that had been sampled and then apparently used in prohibited circumstances or unauthorized circumstances. The trial court found in Havasupai, page 45 of that decision, that section 12.821.01 is not to test the legal sufficiency of the claim or the damages alleged. A notice may not be deemed invalid merely because the amount demanded is not objectively quantifiable. Now, that is important because what the trial court found below was that Paragon did not support the damages alleged for its claims. Now, the case law also discusses the fact that if a party has a stronger case on liability, but perhaps a weaker case on damages, that may result in the same settlement amount as a case that has a strong case for damages, but a weak case for liability. Again, we're looking at this from the claimant's subjective point of view for the facts that would support the amount to settle. Now, we know that ADOT has already admitted to discriminatory conduct. We know that ADOT has already admitted that it improperly collected fees. That was before the FAA decided that ADOT was continuing to impose unlawful restrictions in violation of the FAA's grant assurances. Those arise under the 2018 lease. So those include not being able to offer solo skydiving for customers, which would be a unique and thrilling adventure over the Grand Canyon. The FAA also determined that ADOT imposed an unlawful insurance requirement by requiring it to get insurance that was offered by apparently one, if no insurance providers at all, and the cost that would ensue to get that. Ultimately, Paragon supplied the facts that it believed supported the amount it would settle the case for, and ADOT was certainly in its right to disagree or to make a counteroffer.
Mr. Crane, could you move on to the timeliness requirement on the notice of claim? Could you spend a little time about talking about that?
Certainly. I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
And that kind of leads into the subject matter jurisdiction issue, so I'm going to try to stay away from that for now. But ultimately, the timeliness, the first claim was served on July 19th of 2022. That was 179 days after the director's decision first in the FAA Part 16 complaint. Of course, ADOT appealed. It went to a final agency decision. An amended notice of claim was served again within 180 days. Ultimately, it's Paragon's position that the notice of claim should relate back to 180 days before it began its proceedings in front of the FAA. And that's because, as both parties cite and is relevant to the subject matter jurisdiction arguments, the FAA has exclusive jurisdiction to determine if the lease agreement had provisions that violated the FAA's grant assurances. So Paragon would not have known in 2018 that it actually had a claim. It would not have known that the lease provision actually violated federal law until the FAA made that decision in advance of the first notice of claim. So ultimately,
how far back? So I'm a little bit confused. So in response to the state's motion to dismiss in the Superior Court, I think your client said We're not seeking any damages back to 2016, 2017, correct?
I think that's right, Your Honor.
Okay. In your reply brief here, did you backtrack?
Your Honor, I think we may have backtracked a little bit, but that's counting the 180 days prior to when the informal complaint was started. If this court determines that the 180 days would start from the formal complaint process, then we wouldn't include these the audit fees, the $3,200 that the state found to be inappropriately charged. We'd mostly be talking about the fees that were incurred by Paragon during the pendency of the FAA's action, as well as the attorney's fees that would be permitted or shifted to Paragon for pursuing this claim in front of the FAA, and then the lost revenue that it would have generated from not being able to do solo skydiving. Those would be the damages that Paragon was seeking in the lawsuit below. I want to discuss just a couple brief...
Can I just ask you one question? You said we wouldn't have known, Paragon wouldn't have known that we had a claim until the FAA made a decision on whether we had a claim. But doesn't the fact that you are seeking the FAA's intervention your notice that you may have a claim?
Your Honor, that's correct.
Okay.
We're on notice that we may have a claim, but we don't know at that point in time. Paragon would not know at that point in time if the provisions are actually in violation of federal law.
Right, but is that the standard for filing a notice of claim, is certainty that you have a claim? I mean, isn't it the accrual of knowing that you may have a claim? At the point that you know you may have a claim, you have to file a notice of claim.
Your Honor, that's correct.
Okay. So maybe I misheard what you said, because you said, say again what the significance of the 179 days is vis-a-vis you filing the complaint with the FAA.
Your Honor, the significance is that that is when Paragon knew all of the claims it would have had in terms of the solo skydiving being a restriction that violated FAA grant assurances, that the FAA grant assurances, the insurance requirement was a violation of the FAA grant assurances. Those are things that perhaps Paragon believed that the lease that it was forced into in 2018 or for 2018 violated sections of federal law. It didn't know the full extent, nor did it know it actually suffered any damages at that point in time. Because if the FAA determined that those were appropriate restrictions to have in the lease and not violations of federal law, then Paragon would have suffered no damages as a result of it. So it's that exclusivity of who gets to make the decision of whether or not these provisions violate grant assurances that made it so Paragon did not know until the director's decision came out if it had actually suffered the harm that it may have believed it suffered before. I want to address a few things in terms of the notice of claim. ADOT has tried to argue that this is a some certain case and that the notice of claim should have provided a detailed calculation of the damages. But ADOT's own authority, and this is Short v. Riley discussing lost profit damages and how those would be calculated, discussed that at trial you would have, you could be looking at other business records, you could be looking at trial expert testimony to substantiate that. That's not a some certain amount. That would be something that would be proven at trial. And certainly lost profit damages would be appropriate in a case like this, because at the time the parties entered into the lease, with ADOT demanding in a take it or leave it fashion that Paragon could not offer solo skydiving, when that turns out to be a violation of federal law, that they would understand that during that time period, Paragon was unable to offer a service which would have been presumably profitable and restricted so by ADOT in an unlawful manner. ADOT also attempts to portray this case as being about 2017, but we've covered kind of the timeliness aspect of it. That's not what this case is about. This case is about violations for the by ADOT in the 2018 lease moving forward. I'm going to move now to subject matter jurisdiction. And I'm going to start by distinguishing this case. The declaratory relief claim is not about seeking the trial court's affirmation as to the grant assurances. It's about seeking, and this is paragraph 97 of the amended complaint, which is index of record 47, but seeking compliance with the Federal Aviation Administration's decision. And we talked about this briefly, but it's the Asheville Jet case, which both parties cited, where it quotes in page 167 of that decision, this is in front of the North Carolina Appellate Court, that the FAA has sole jurisdiction to make the initial determination of an airport's alleged violation of grant assurances. We have that here. The FAA made its decision that ADOT violated grant assurances through contractual restrictions it put in the 2018 lease. That distinguishes some of the other cases that are discussed by the parties in the briefing, like the Arapahoe case, because this isn't something where we're seeking the trial court to rule on the Federal Aviation Administration's grant assurance power. We're not trying to invade that. We already have that decision. We just want ADOT to comply with what the Federal Aviation Administration has said. Importantly, in a quote from the Platinum Aviation matter in Asheville, it also notes that the FAA neither approves nor monitors agreements between the airport sponsors and airport tenants. The FAA doesn't do that. That's a job for the state court. The FAA does not arbitrate disputes through the Part 16 complaint process, nor does the FAA enforce contract terms between the parties to an agreement that the FAA is not a party to. The FAA is not a party to this lease. And the FAA does not enforce the contract terms. So if ADOT takes, as was the case here, approximately 17 months to come into what is facial compliance with the FAA's restrictions, during that time period, Paragon has a valid claim for declaratory relief that it should not have to be forced under threat of eviction to have unlawful insurance requirements or not be able to offer solo skydiving services. Finally, I'm going to address the attorney's fees, and I'll do so very shortly and reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. In awarding attorney's fees, the trial court seems to have not considered the fact that Paragon, again, facially appears to have accomplished half of its goal. Yes, Paragon filed four claims that sought damages, and Paragon did not accomplish that. As was previously discussed, we think that that issue should be returned. But Paragon did, again, according to a request for judicial notice, which ADOT filed in December 9th of 2024, ADOT finally had from the FAA, and I don't have the rest of the communications. I'd love to see the rest of the communications between ADOT and the FAA. But the FAA finally told ADOT, you have a lease that we think cures the issues that we have. So ultimately, it took almost 18 months for ADOT to come into compliance with a claim that Paragon had asserted. Again, that goes into to facts that are not alleged in the face of the complaint, which is what the decision should be based upon to determine subject matter jurisdiction. But ultimately, it took that long, but Paragon did make progress. I'll also note that there were two motions to dismiss filed in this case. Paragon lost the first one. Paragon won the second one, at least in part, before the court asked for subject matter briefing on the subject matter jurisdiction issue. So we believe the court here abused its discretion in determining that the FAA was the prevailing party, given the circumstances and the fact that there is a subject matter jurisdiction dismissal. Unless the court has any, the panel has any further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Bruce Smith on behalf of Appalese, the State of Arizona, and the Arizona Department of Transportation. I'm going to focus on the two completely separate parts of this case. We have the declaratory judgment action and we have the notice of claim. I'm going to first start with the declaratory judgment action. Paragon initiated a formal FAA process. There are detailed regulations in the Code of Federal Regulations talking about all the steps that one must go to when you initiate the Part 16 process. Paragon knew what it was doing, and it knew what it was getting itself into. Paragon knew that when it initiated this process, if it prevailed, the FAA would make a final decision and would say, we think there are these grant assurance problems. Once the FAA makes that final decision, then the regulations and the FAA manual say, we then go into the compliance phase. And that's what Paragon completely ignores, and that's the problem with their declaratory judgment action. They say, we are seeking compliance with the FAA decision. But then they say, we are not seeking to invade the grant assurance process. They are seeking to invade the grant assurance process because when they filed the lawsuit, the FAA moved into the compliance phase. And that's when the FAA deals with ADOT and says, are you getting rid of the insurance requirements? Are you getting rid of the solo skydiving limitation? Yes, yes. The delay in this case was a delay in getting a new lease form to the FAA. And in December of 2024, the FAA saw a final lease that it examined, and it determined this draft lease complies with grant assurances. In December of 2024, the FAA then said, this FAA case is over. You are now in compliance. But what was Paragon asking a Superior Court judge to do in 2023 and 2024? It was asking a Superior Court judge, we want you to invade this process, and we want you to make a declaration about something that happened within the administrative process. So, yes, they are invading the FAA's process here. The other problems with their arguments, if they wanted a court to say you violated grant assurances, Congress provided one exclusive remedy, and that is to file a petition with an appellate court, either the D.C. Circuit or the Ninth Circuit, saying we want you to look at this final order and we want you to affirm it. That was their sole judicial remedy to say you violated these three grant assurance issues. They did not. And when they did not appeal it, that means that they no longer had a legal avenue to pursue to seek a declaratory judgment.
Hey, Mr. Smith, it seems pretty clear to me that the Act grants the FAA exclusive jurisdiction to enforce grant assurances, but what about a dispute over a contract? Help me understand why state courts don't get to decide those issues.
No, the states do get to enforce contract issues, and when you read the Arapaho case, and when you read the Platinum Aviation case that was decided by the FAA, when you read those cases together, the language delineates what appears to be a clear demarcation. We decide grant assurances, courts decide breach of contract issues. What becomes muddled is when you look at the facts of the Arapaho case. In Arapaho, someone went and they started airline functions before they had FAA approval. They went through the state court process. They got rulings. And then the FAA says, no, you can't do that. And the Tenth Circuit basically told the Colorado Supreme Court, no, this is our bailiwick. You don't get to decide that. So I agree with Paragon that when you have if the FAA comes in and says there is a grant assurance issue, for example, the solo skydiving limitation, right, when you have that, if there is a breach of contract issue stemming from that grant assurance, they get to say, you breached a contract term, I have money damages. The difficulty is when you want to do both processes, a legal proceeding and an administrative proceeding at the same time. That's when it becomes very muddled, in my opinion. But
so you're saying because the declaratory relief action is outside of the contract and is in the FAA process, then that's the demarcation that the state courts don't have any right to make a declaratory relief for something that happened in the administrative process.
Right, and there's three lines of cases that are applicable to that point. One there is no implied right of action to enforce the grant assurances.
Right.
That's really what they're trying to do. A second line of cases say when you have an administrative process that you can't appeal, you have to do that, but you can't go then and file a second lawsuit and initiate litigation to basically follow up on the administrative process. And then the third line of cases is really some old Arizona cases on the limitations of a declaratory judgment, and that is declaratory judgments are not supposed to be used to follow up on or get further clarification on what a prior court did. And that's the same principle here. We want an Arizona Superior Court to come in and say, aha, this is what the FAA decided. As a practical matter, with this declaratory judgment action and then the FAA compliance process, how is a court supposed to manage that? So you file a declaratory judgment action that says you violated this grant assurance, but the FAA is then monitoring the defendant to come into compliance, and then, like in this case, in December of 2024, they say you have achieved compliance. At that point, everything else being equal, the case becomes moot. Because the court then has to say, well, there may have been a violation in 2023, but now you're in compliance, so I'm declaring that ADOT is now in compliance with grant assurances. The FAA has already said that. Those are the problems with trying to come in and say, we have a declaratory judgment action, basically another form of appeal.
Could the Superior Court say the issue is moot?
No. As that was a practical example. What the Superior Court should say is, I don't have jurisdiction to I don't even have jurisdiction to wade into that issue.
In other words, that what is happening in the administrative process just speaks for itself. You can use that in your litigation about what the timeline was and that we violated grant assurance, but having a declaratory judgment as to that fact is unnecessary on top of the court's not, I mean,
yeah,
they
no
certainly get to argue that in their contract action.
There's no jurisdiction to go there. I mean, there's no jurisdiction to go there, and as a practical matter, why do you need it? Because you have the agency decision, nobody appealed it, but then you have then you have the compliance process, and the FAA says that ADOT came into compliance.
Was the compliance process talked to, did the parties talk about that in the Superior Court?
We did not. That was not something that was briefed. It came into the record in the case at the tail end when we were arguing the jurisdictional issue, and then we filed a notice of the decision, and that was before the court.
Okay, so are you saying that Judge Corey didn't have access to this idea of what the compliance portion of the FEA's process, what the how that affected whether or not the declaratory judgment action should be live in his court? I'm not understanding, because that seems like something a little bit that I didn't think the Superior Court was really considering, that somehow this compliance process is relevant to whether you can get a declaratory judgment.
I will be honest with you, Judge Bailey, that the compliance process itself was not briefed until that became an issue. But what does appear in the record is there were exchanges between counsel, and we brought it to the attention of the court. We're in compliance. Why are we here? Why is the declaratory judgment action still in this case?
But wasn't there a response to that we shouldn't? I mean, they had a reason for wanting that declaratory action, even though they knew a compliance action was taking place. So it's not, I'm not really understanding that.
Well, the first issue for the trial court and the one that it accepted is, I don't have jurisdiction to enter a declaratory judgment. So it doesn't have to technically reach the compliance issue. When I thought about it more fully, and thought about how is the declaratory judgment action wading into the province of the FAA, that's when it became clear to me in my mind that it's not just an informal we win, we lose. It's also that secondary phase of compliance. The FAA's jurisdiction is not only calling balls and strikes on a violation, it is our goal as the FAA is to make sure that the airports nationwide come into compliance. And so when there's a violation, we work with the airport to come get you into compliance, which they did here. That is the administrative process. That is the process that Congress has set up, and no federal or state court gets to invade that process. It's strictly an administrative process.
Okay, thank you.
With regard to the notice of claim, this is a business case. This is not a personal injury case involving a permanent injury, and you say, how much is a quadriplegic case worth? I lost my mom and dad in a car crash. What is my loss of consortium worth? Plaintiff's counsel, Paragon's counsel said, look at the Havasupai case. The Havasupai case was about an invasion of privacy. What do we look to say, what is the value of someone obtaining medical information or test results, and how does one value that? You don't know. There's no medical bills to look at. There's no lost profit calculations that can be made. It is a personal and subjective belief on the part of the individuals from the Havasupai tribe about what they believe is the value of that invasion of privacy claim.
So are you just quibbling with their estimate of their lost profit?
No. We are quibbling with the notice of claim and the estimate of lost profits. You don't.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So the idea that they said that you charged fees and that you, I mean, all of those things, when I look at it anyway, I think you were in this with them. I mean, the idea of what fees you charged and where those came from and all of those kind of contract-based, you were in it with them the whole time. Those wouldn't be a mystery to ADOT about, I mean, them having to calculate what the fees were when they just say, look, we had $255,000 in fees that you charged us, that the FAA has said you overcharged us. That feels like a little bit easier hurdle to get over factually, that there is, that there was sufficient evidence of that. And so what I'm asking is, are you saying that their number of $2 million in lost profits is somehow incalculable, and from your perspective, they didn't give you any numbers on that, and so you're just completely lost as to how the fact that over years and years they were subject to things that the FAA said were not correct, and that they wouldn't have lost any profits as a result of that? Like, help me understand. That's why I was saying, are you really just quibbling with the fact that they gave this big number in lost profits, and you're saying we have no way to calculate that because they didn't give us any factual information to back it up?
I'm quibbling with the fact that they didn't comply with the notice of claim statute. The Arizona Supreme Court in either the Backus or the recent Ryan case made clear that you have to have strict compliance with the statute. The legislature said you have to have a settlement amount, and you have to have facts in the notice of claim that support that settlement amount. Paragon's position is a circular argument. Oh, well, we talked about liability facts, therefore that supports our damages. The legislature wrote the statute with two sentences. There are two separate requirements, and in the Backus case, when they talked about the facts supporting argument, they said facts supporting the amount is an element.
When it says we would have lost revenue estimated at over $2 million, what's wrong with that? What's missing from that? It's pretty self-explanatory.
How do you calculate lost revenue?
Well, do they have to provide their method of calculation, or are they simply informing you of the facts that we expected we would have earned this, and we didn't.
You have to provide some calculations, because as the Ryan Court...
Is calculation the right word before you go any further? I mean, we also have case law that says it's the claimant's subjective... it's their subjective notion of what is sufficient evidence. And if they just said, we lost $2 million, X, but they said in lost profits, and they're tying it to the fact that over many years, they had, their theory is that they've been iced out of doing things that would have brought them increased profits. So I think that kind of ties into your, they're telling you it's lost profit. It's in the scope of the fact that we've been in a contract with you to do something that you, the FAA has said you should not have prevented us from doing that would have profited our business. So what would be missing? And you said calculation, and I'm not sure I see that in the case law.
Yes. What you have to... Let me find these. In the Ryan case, 2024, the Supreme Court said the facts, the factual element requires, quote, factual foundation to permit the entity, or ADOT, to evaluate the amount claimed, ensuring that the amount claimed is more than a quick, unrealistic, exaggerated demand. How do you do that with this record?
But there are also cases that say a pie-in-the-sky number is not a bar to having a proper notice of claim. So how should we square those two concepts?
You follow the Arizona Supreme Court, and you say you have to have some foundation in your notice of claim to say this is how we calculated $2 million in lost revenue. This is how we calculated these excess fees that were charged.
So is a notice of claim like a disclosure statement? You have to lay out your case?
You have to lay out your case, yes. And in this case, we're talking about business losses. We paid too much fees. We paid too much for an insurance policy with too high of a coverage amount. You have to lay it out just so we know, so the state knows, or Maricopa County knows, or the city of Tucson knows how you are arriving at this number, because it is a strict statute, and the case law also says a governmental entity doesn't have to go through searching through its own files to try and figure out how you calculated it. You have to go to the governmental agency, and you have to tell them how to do it. That's why in our brief we said, if you paid too much for an insurance premium, what's that amount? How do you calculate it? It's simple. It's straightforward. And the other problem is they didn't provide us with any information or any calculations, which the court said. I looked for it. I looked through the record, and there's nothing here. One of the concerns of the state in the Backus case was people are going to hold back how they calculate these damages and provide the factual support. And the Supreme Court said, we think people are going to give you that information. We don't think that lawyers are going to hold back on that. But the concern that the state and the other governmental entities had in Backus is exactly what we have here. We paid too much in fees, but we're not going to tell you how we got that number. We have lost revenue, and my time is up. Can I finish my thought, please?
Your time is up.
We have lost
sir,
revenue.
Your time is up, sir.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Crane.
Thank you. Just a few quick points on rebuttal. The case law does not require a calculation in the notice of claim. It does not require disclosure level proof of a damages calculation. It does not require trial level evidence. It requires what the claimant believes are facts that would support it. And here, Paragon believed that putting together $2 million plus $255,000 would support a settlement in the neighborhood of $300,000 initially. The court asked a few questions about compliance and was that raised below. And I want to go back to just a quote that I mentioned from the Platinum Aviation case. This is from the FAA itself, page 18 of that decision. The FAA neither approves nor monitors agreements between airport sponsors and airport tenants. There may have been a compliance that was going on between ADOT and the FAA, but the FAA is not monitoring whether or not Paragon's rights are being protected. That's something that Paragon, a lessee of a in a contract in Arizona, has state courts to help it with, to make sure that somebody is not enforcing a provision that violates federal law, which at that point in time had been decided. The court also asked questions about whether or not declaratory relief could be obtained. Declaratory relief here, as was put forth in that count, paragraph 97, again, of the First Amendment complaint, wanted a declaration as to Paragon's contractual rights. That's not a declaration as to whether or not the FAA had violated grant assurances. We already had that. At that point in time, it was whether or not Paragon had a lease that it could be forced out of operation at the Grand Canyon National Park Airport over what Paragon perceived and understood the FAA had already decided. Paragon shouldn't have to live in fear of eviction or having to comply with contractual requirements that the FAA found violated it. And then finally, Your Honor, you asked a question earlier about couldn't Paragon have brought the claim earlier or sent the notice of claim prior to pursuing the FAA decisions? And I think I missed a step with my brain in answering that question, because in paragraph 26 of the complaint, Paragon alleged that that ADOT had told it needed to pursue any further claims with the FAA. So under 12.82.101, I think subsection C, the claim would be told during this administrative process. And the fact that both parties agree, getting the FAA to decide if there's a violation of a grant assurance, that's in the exclusive, at least the initial decision, is in the exclusive decision-making power of the FAA, so it would be told during that time period. Unless the court has anything further for me, I'll give you back 30 seconds of your day.
Thank you. And thank you, counsel. We will take this under advisement and issue our ruling in due course. We're adjourned.